Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes. Welcome back to the show. If you've missed the show, you can blame Bulldog Sports for that. We've been off the air a few weeks because of sports conflicts. That's going to happen again next week with the New Mexico Bowl. But we do have the show today, and I think it's going to be a very entertaining one. Speaking of Bulldog Sports, don't forget to go to the Save Mart Center tonight for Fresno State and Brigham Young on the basketball court. But now let's get to the topic of this show. If you are a fan of Hometown Heroes, you know that each week we visit with World War II veterans. We hear their experiences from the war. We want to honor their service and their sacrifice, preserve those stories for the rest of us to enjoy, and hopefully maybe along the way be inspired by the love for our country that these men and women from the Greatest Generation demonstrate every day. Don Kitterman is no exception to that. He's 90 years old. He lives in Mount Shasta, which is where he grew up. Spent some time right around World War II time in Fresno at Hammer Field. But let's get started early on, Don. You're 90 years old, so that tells me that when Pearl Harbor happened in 1941, you must have been about 21, 22.
That's right.
Where were you at the time? How did you hear about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor?
Well, I was working in the Logan Woods on the north fork of the Sacramento River, right at the very head of the river. And we went down to the old truck for lunch. And that was on a Monday morning, and it come over the radio on the truck. And we was all pretty well shook up over it. And
did you realize at that time that this was going to change your life?
Well, it had to, and I knew it. Yes, I knew that.
Now,
fact is, I had in my head that I was going to be in it, and I enlisted later.
Well, and we're going to talk about some of the things you did, including your very interesting work with a rare airplane that doesn't get a whole lot of publicity, the P-61 Black Widow. But anybody who served in the Army Air Corps in World War II, every veteran I think that I've talked to that ended up in the Air Corps chose that branch of service because he wanted to be a pilot. Was that the story for you?
No, it wasn't. I never wanted to be a pilot. I enlisted, and they put me in an aeronautical school, made an aircraft mechanic out of me.
Uh-huh.
And from there, I was advanced to crew chief and then aerial engineer.
Now, when did you get your first taste of action? When did you find out you were going overseas?
In July in 44.
So the war had been raging for a while, and you'd probably seen all the headlines and heard about this and that?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Were you actually anxious at that point to get over there?
Well, yeah, I may be not anxious, curious. I just couldn't let that go by without seeing what was happening.
Now, a lot of the veterans that I talked to, they maybe left behind a sweetheart as they went off to war and came back and got married later on, or maybe they met someone during the course of the war, and there are so many of us from my generation who wouldn't be here if people like you didn't come home from the war. But I understand you had your sweetheart before this all got started.
Yeah, I was married, and the daughter you talked to, it was just a baby.
Your daughter, Ralph, told me all about you, so that's why I've got some good material to pepper you with questions today, but you were the star quarterback at Mount Shasta High School?
No, I was a captain. I was of the team. I wasn't the quarterback. I was a defensive tackle.
But I understand you caught the attention of one of the cheerleaders from your arch-rival school.
Yeah, I did that. I finally married her, and she was Ralph's mother.
Is that a forgivable offense at your high school, to marry the opposition?
Well, I haven't been back, let's put it that way.
And how long have you been married now?
It will be 70 years next June.
How about that? Hats off to you for that. And so when you went off to war, you were leaving behind a wife and a small child. How difficult was that for you to realize you may never come back?
Yeah, and it was difficult. But I never had the feeling I wouldn't come back. I told her when I left it I'd see her later, and I did.
You were a man of your word, and
yeah,
probably had a little help in accomplishing that. So were you assigned to a Black Widow squadron right off the bat?
Well, actually, we were trained in A-20s or P-70s. They were night fighters here in the United States. And when we got overseas, our airplanes was in crates, and when they put them together, they were P-61s.
So you got a little surprised when you opened the crates.
You bet we did.
So here you are, halfway across the world, and you're working with an airplane that you've never seen or experienced before in your life?
That's right, except we had some very good help. That was at Melny Bay, New Guinea. When we had a set of deck orders like a library, every part of those things was listed out to put them together.
Now, I think a lot of our listeners may not be familiar with the P-61 Black Widow. If you can, maybe give us a quick tutorial on what that plane was like, what its function was, and then maybe what your role on your crew was.
Well, the Black Widow has a distance, looks similar to a P-38. It is double-boomed, however, it's a lot larger. It's a three-place job, and it's made of painted black. Had radar, and that was a hush-hush thing those days. And the three-man crew, the radar operator, the gunner engineer, and the pilot. And
you were the gunner engineer?
Yes.
So what did your duties consist of on an average mission?
Just ride along the gun seat. And our missions, by the time we got there, the air war was about over. And the most of our missions was just we'd find the front lines at night, and you could tell the difference in the color of the Jap artillery than ours. So when we seen the Jap open up, we'd open up on him, and he'd shut him down usually. And the guys down in the jungle liked us pretty good, and they heard us buzzing around up there at night. They got some sleep.
So you got shot at quite a bit.
Yeah, quite a bit at times.
And, you know, I said an average mission a moment ago. I know there's no such thing as an average mission.
No. I never had too much combat experience.
Well, I know you had some interesting experiences that we're going to talk about. And obviously, you talk about the Black Widow looking kind of like a P-38 being black.
Yeah.
And it's black because you were doing all of your missions at night, correct?
That's right.
Had you ever trained at all back home in night fighting?
Oh, yes, in Florida for a year and a half.
Okay, in the A-20 you had trained.
In the A-20, sure.
All right. Now, I know you've got some terrifically exciting experiences, including the role that your unit played in the Great Raid, as it's been called, the raid on Kabanatuan that freed American prisoners of war who had been stuck there for a long time and probably would have died there without that daring rescue. We're going to talk about that. Also about when you saw General MacArthur and his famous return to the Philippines. And I know you've got many more stories, maybe even some poetry that you might share with us today.
Well, yeah.
All right.
I thought, you know, one that comes to mind is just when we came into the Philippines, they told us there's going to be there 21 years because there's only 7,000 islands. We had to take one back every day to do that. So we knew it was going to be there a while. And when we got to Luzon, we had a little thatch camp built, and we arranged a squadron fund so we could hire our own kitchen police and all that, with the things we didn't like to do. But one of these guys was a little Filipino boy that didn't quite have all his, well, he's playing the short deck. And he was a queer-looking guy. He wore a pith helmet somebody gave him and a pair of GI shorts, GI pants cut off into shorts, and number 12 GI shoes that turned up about 2 inches in the front. His feet was wider than it was long. But anyway, one of his duties was to go to the latrines and once a day and put a little gasoline in them and set them afire to keep them sanitary. Just then flash it, kill anything that's in there.
I smell trouble brewing.
Well, this captain went out there this morning and before this, so he went out there and put his gasoline in the officer's latrine and probably put a gallon in there, felt in his shorts, and he didn't have any matches, and he went back to the mess hall to get some matches. In the meantime, the captain went out there and sat down one hole, lit a cigarette, and threw the match down the other one and blew himself clear out of that place. And he always claimed that he was the one that invented the ejection seat for airplanes from that experience.
Well, that would certainly do it. And obviously, if he always claimed that, he was okay afterwards.
Yeah, he was pretty badly burned. He spent a long time in the hospital.
But he sure had a great story to tell.
Yeah, he did. Well, the rest of that story was about 3 weeks later, there was an explosion out there and it sounded like a 500-pound bomb. And we went out there and the enlisted men's latrine was just a hole in the ground with half-burnt toilet paper and the palm trees around it and no Carpung, that's the guy's name was that. And he never showed up again. We never knew what happened to him.
So this time he completely blew it up.
He completely blew it up, but he wasn't there. And no one ever knew how he did it.
One of the mysteries of World War II that remains to this day.
That's right. That's one of the exciting times.
Well, it's about that time where we need to take a brief break, but when we come back, we'll hear more of the experiences of Don Kitterman. He's now 90 years old, but he still remembers clearly the role that his unit, the 547th Night Fighter Squadron, played in the raid at Kabanatuan. We'll hear about that, maybe hear a little rhyming, some of the poetry he wrote during the war, and the rest of his memories from World War II. This is Hometown Heroes. We'll be right back on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Remember, if there's a World War II veteran in your life that you think I ought to catch up with, shoot me an email, paul@kmjnow.com. My guest today, 90-year-old Don Kitterman. He's up at Mount Shasta. He spent some time around World War II here in the valley in Fresno and Hammerfield. We'll hear about that. But first, I want to hear about life in the Pacific. And, Don, there have been a lot of things commemorating the great victories won in the Pacific. And there are also a lot of things that have been written about what life was like on some of these islands. And while you had lots of guys to be around and to build that camaraderie with, sometimes it wasn't the most glamorous existence, was it? Now, I've read some things. There was an island, Pavuvu, that seems to be one of the most dreadful places for Marines. And for you, I guess Muay Thai was one of your least favorite places?
That was one of them.
And what inspired you to start writing poetry about the rough existence that you faced?
I don't know. I just have gotten making those little rhymes for my kids and grandkids, and it ended up I've got a book full of them.
And this one on Muay Thai, you actually wrote about 50 years later, is that right?
About 50 years later, yeah.
Well, I'll read it for our listeners, and maybe you can explain a little bit of it and put it in context for them. So here is the poem Muay Thai, written about an island in the Pacific by Don Kitterman, 50 years after he spent so many days there. Here it goes. Far east of the prime meridian, north just 2 degrees, there by Halmahera, close to Celebes, lies the Isle of Muay Thai, a place not very nice, just another atoll far from paradise. Beaches awash with cuttlefish that stink to heaven high. Seems they move close in on shore when it comes up time to die. Land crabs as large as poodle dogs with eyes on 2-inch stalks, claws that resemble pruning hooks that clatter when they walk. This is a land of many ills. Dengue and beriberi, black water fever and jungle rot, amoebic dysentery. Leeches, lice, and scorpions, all kinds of crawling critters, bats as big as seagulls to give a man the jitters. Water comes from a Lister bag and has an awful stink. It's doctored up with chemicals to make it fit to drink. Now, if you're in search of a private aisle, this one's to avoid. On the galded arse of Mother Earth, it's an inflamed hemorrhoid. You must have had fun with that last little line.
Yeah.
Characterizing more time.
I didn't want to read that under the air.
So, but, you must have really liked this place.
No, I didn't like that place. The worst part of that place was those darn land crabs. Boy, they were terrible. If you killed one of them and he stinks a bad, you couldn't be on the island with him, apparently.
So here you think you're over there to fight the Japanese, and you're fighting nature more than anything.
That's right.
How was the morale of the men that you served with? I mean, this sounds, what you're facing here, just on this island and the stuff you have to deal with every day, it doesn't sound very pleasant, but was morale up? What was it like?
I think in my squadron, they were, well, we had a commanding officer that was concerned about his men, and he got the best he could. He did the best he could for us, and we did the best we could for him, and morale was pretty high.
I guess when you have a lot of guys to commiserate with about these different things you faced, it makes it all a little easier?
Well, yeah, maybe. If you're with a bunch of men that'll do what they're supposed to do, do their jobs, and do them well, there's no reason to have bad morale.
Now, I've talked to a lot of veterans, hundreds of World War II veterans. The one thing that strikes me is, to a man, they tell me that they felt a unity in the men that they served with and also the people back home. And here you had a wife and a daughter back home that you have in mind constantly. Did you have that feeling that you were all pulling on the same end of the rope, that you were all focused on the same thing?
Right. That's right. We just felt like that we were there to do the job, and it was more or less just that. You did your little stint, and no, I think morale in our, at least in my squadron, was very high.
How often did you get a letter from your wife?
Well, I'd done a little time in the hospital, and I got 96 female letters from my wife in one day.
96 and one. They had to catch up to you at the hospital.
Well, finally caught up with me when I got back after the outfit.
Well, there's an obvious next question after you told me that. How'd you end up in the hospital?
I picked up something they call scrub typhus that they didn't know much about then and they don't know much about yet, I guess.
But I bet it wasn't much fun.
No, it wasn't. It was bad. Two guys died of it as well. It has caused me a tick bite. We'd went in swimming on the island of Indoro and threw our clothes up in a drift. And when we come back, there were just little yellow bugs all over them, and we just shook them out and put them on. And their bites caused that.
Did that cause you to miss any missions that you were supposed to fly?
Oh, yeah. I was in the hospital for a month, about 2 months, really.
How hard was that for you to know on such a small crew, a three-man crew, that these two guys you spent so much time with were up there without you?
They traded off. They had other guys that took my place, and I wasn't missed, I don't think.
Well, they might tell me a different story.
Yeah, well, maybe.
Well, I want to hear about your role, the role that your plane and your squadron played in what's been called the Great Raid. They made a movie of it a couple of years ago.
The Cabana Tawan Raid, that prison.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that prison is 30-some miles back of the Jap lines.
Mm-hmm.
And a scout outfit went in and got them out.
Yeah, there were some rangers. I've interviewed one of those rangers who was part of that raid on the ground, and I was not aware of the distractionary role, the decoy role that that your group played.
Well, a fellow named Schreiber did that decoy role, and he was pretty good at it. He was a guy none of us much liked to fly with. He was a little bit too daring.
A risk taker, huh?
He took an airplane right over camp just before the scouts went in there and throttled back and got his engine backfiring and it just flew on over a little ridge and dropped a big old smoke bomb, and it got a bunch of the guys evidently out of there. They got them over to see what had happened.
So it was supposed to appear like a plane crash.
Yeah, immediately.
And that distracted the forces on the ground and helped the ability of the Rangers to go in there and free the prisoners?
That's right. And that movie, there's two movies made of that. The first one made of it used some actual combat footage that those Rangers had. They had a camera, evidently. And it shows that old Black Widow up there. The second one didn't. It showed a B-25. But
they couldn't find a Black Widow to use in the movie, probably.
No. Well, they couldn't. But that first one was a combat footage.
And for those who aren't familiar with the story, and the most recent movie was called The Great Raid, but the basic story is these are American prisoners of war. Some civilians who were prisoners of war there, some Bataan Death March survivors, many emaciated Americans who, didn't die from malnutrition, might have died by execution. It was that late in the war, and that was the implication. And this was a real gutsy deal by American forces to go in and free them. Did you know at the time what your group was doing and what the overall goal of this mission was?
Yeah, pretty much. We flew, just vectored over them as they come out that night.
Mm-hmm.
And they were imaginated bunch, you bet.
Now, what did you see from your vantage point? You said it's at night. Could you see anything?
No, we vectored over them for 40 minutes, and that's all I was in.
So you were providing air cover for the forces on the ground.
Yeah, air cover, and they had some purple flashlights. And we can recognize them by that, and we just vector around there to keep anything off of them. Nothing happened along those lines.
I imagine at some point, though, you probably read about the prisoners being freed, maybe saw some pictures in Life magazine or something like that. What did it mean to you when you realized how great of a victory and a success that was for American forces?
Well, I never really thought it was a great success until just back in 1995. I still have it here in my desk somewhere. My commanding officer wrote me a letter, and his name was Odell, William Odell.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that was the only successful rescue of prisoners since the Civil War, and there'd been two or three lately that was just turned out to be a bad deal.
Yeah, it's a very risky thing because you're just as soon to kill the prisoners as you are to save them.
Yeah, that was the thing they were afraid of when they went in there. Now, I assume that. But that was about one of the main things that my squadron did, got a little recognition for.
How big, how many planes were on that mission? Do you remember?
I think five at different times. Mm-hmm. Five different airplanes, and they brought them boys out of there in carts pulled by water buffalo. A lot of them couldn't walk.
Our listeners can look up, and I'll post some links on our website, kmjnow.com. You see some of the pictures of these prisoners. The number was 511. That's how many American and Allied prisoners of war were set free by that daring raid at Cabanatuan on the Philippine island of Luzon. And most of them were survivors of the Bataan Death March, or at least the fall of Bataan and Corregidor. So they had been there for going on 3 years.
Yeah, I heard one of them say in the hospital, I was in the hospital with one of them guys, he said that morning the guards had all left. And they sat around wondering about it. Said they'd seen the P-38s coming by once in a while. And long in the evening, some German soldier with big pockets on his pants stepped up in the door and says, "Anybody here from Brooklyn?" And they didn't recognize his uniform. They wore the old-fashioned tight-to-neck uniforms of World War I.
Go figure. Because they had that equipment at the start of the war before Bataan and Corregidor fell.
Yeah, they had them big old saddlebag pockets. They didn't know who he was. But they took him out of there at night. And I don't think they... Oh, their fight was pretty brisk, but I don't think it lasted very long.
No, from all accounts, it was a very quick, and that was part of its success, was how fast it was. And your night fighter squadron played a key role in that mission.
Yeah, we got a little recognition from the acting president of the Philippines over that.
Well deserved. Well, it's time to take another break here on the program, but when we come back, we'll hear some more of Don Kitterman's experiences during World War II with the 547th Night Fighter Squadron. We'll ask him about when he came back from the war, too. I imagine seeing his wife and daughter was pretty special once he got home. We'll be right back with the rest of Hometown Heroes. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. A very enjoyable discussion today with Don Kitterman, veteran of the U.S. Army Air Corps in World War II. He served with the 547th Night Fighter Squadron as a gunner engineer on a P-61 Black Widow, one of the more fascinating airplanes of World War II. You heard him describe the role of his squadron in the daring raid on Kabanatuan in January of 1945 that freed 511 American and Allied prisoners of war who were near death at the time. I know those people were very thankful for all the Americans who helped set them free. Don Kitterman, one of those folks, and he has some other stories to tell, including, I understand, Don, you have a good story about the first P-51 Mustang you ever saw.
Yeah, it was one I've never heard of again, too. I was carrying my laundry across a grassy knoll, and I heard an airplane coming, and as I flopped, I thought I recognized it as a Jap Zeke. But it pulled right out over the base and made 7 slow rolls, victory rolls. Huh. And I was told that this man had just come in as a replacement, and he had flown right into a flight of Jap airplanes and shot 7 of them down on his first mission. Now, I've never heard of that again, either.
I might have to look up and see who that was.
I'd like to know who that was.
Well, give me some time to do some research. I might track that down for you. So he did 7 victory rolls for the 7 kills he had produced on his very first mission.
Over the island of Mindoro. And a Zeke resembled a P-51. A lit enough that I mistook it for a Jap.
And you said that's the first P-51 you ever saw.
That's the first one I'd ever seen, yeah.
And I bet you recognized that sound from there on out.
Oh, boy. Yeah, there were some airplane, those things.
And that's one of the treats of going to an air show these days, is there are still some P-51s that fly, and once you hear one hum, you know it's a P-51.
Hey, you bet. That just got a hum, and that's just about all it says.
Now, not P-51s, but P-61s were the Black Widows that you served on, and I understand that at one point you were sleeping under the wing of your P-61 on the island of Leyte.
She told you a lot of stories, didn't she?
Well, I want to hear them from you.
There
was a red alert on Leyte, and you were sleeping under your plane?
Yeah, that was, I think, 3 days after they had went there, when they had got an airstrip there, and they needed some parts. And we flew them up from Biak, which is a long trip over a lot of old enemy-held territory.
Mm-hmm.
And we landed there, and it had been raining. And we had jungle hammocks, and we just hung them up to bomb shackles on our wings, can be kind of out of that misty rain. And all night long, we slept there. They'd throw up red alert flares, and you're supposed to get in a foxhole. We didn't have any foxholes, so we used an old Laterna scraper sitting there, the bucket. We'd get in that, and we was up and down all night. And then about daylight, they threw up a red alert, and this captain says, "Kitterman, come on, let's get in the protection." And I said, "The hell with it, I ain't going to do it." But I laid there for a few minutes, and a Filipino rooster come right down by my bunk and crowing, and I just thought, well, he'll make good breakfast. and I took out after him. And I just about catch up with him, and I heard an airplane, and I looked up, and there was a jet airplane with meatballs all over it. And he toggled a little bomb, and how close to me it hit, I don't know. But the next thing I knew, I was in that Laterna with my hands up over my head, and this captain was leaning over and looking there laughing at me, and I got him told off pretty good. But that's the end of that story.
That rooster caused a little trouble there for
it
you.
It caused a little trouble, yeah. We wasn't just sure what we was going to have for breakfast. That looked pretty good.
Oh, boy. Now, also on the island of Leyte, one of the reasons that island is famous from the World War II era is it marked General MacArthur's return, famously wading back ashore with his corncob pipe sticking out of his mouth. And I understand you didn't just see pictures of that or film of it.
No,
you saw it in the flesh.
I was a witness to it at a distance.
Tell me about that and what the significance was to you at the time.
Well, we all thought it was kind of foolish as always. There was a GI city right there where he could have ended up on a pier if he'd wanted to.
He wanted to make it look a little more dramatic,
yeah,
huh?
He was a showman, and maybe for good reason. But we was all kind of disgusted over it. One of his orders was, now this is about, maybe you can figure out how the GIs felt about him. We knew he was a good tactician.
Right.
But he put out the order, and it was signed by him on our bulletin board, and there's that we were not to call Filipino nationals gooks. We call them Filipino nationals. And that didn't go over big with the general public of the Army, you know.
Different times back then.
Yeah.
And I suppose some of you referred to him as Dugout Doug.
Oh, many of us did. And by the way, we was in the Army Air Force those days. We were part of the Army, not it wasn't the Air Corps, the Air Force.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That didn't happen until after World War II that it became the U.S. Air Force. So you saw MacArthur come back ashore, and a little later on, you saw something else that I don't think too many people have heard of. Everyone has seen the footage of the surrender being signed on the USS Missouri.
No, I never saw that. Something wrong there. I wasn't there.
No, I'm not saying you were there.
Oh, yeah.
Pardon me, but we've all seen those pictures on the USS Missouri, but you actually witnessed something that led up to that.
You were on
the island of Aishima, which is famous as the place where Ernie Pyle, the American newspaper reporter, correspondent, was killed during the war. And you saw something that I don't think you expected to see. Tell me about that. You saw some Betty bombers come in?
Oh, those Betty bombers, yeah. They came in there. But the island was crawling with people. We never knew. We'd just come in from the Philippines. And this strip, they got our airplanes all in revetments or in hard stands and shoved everybody back way away from that strip with men at rifle one. There's holding that crowd back. I think maybe there had to be 50,000 soldiers watching that.
So you knew something was going on.
We knew something was going on, and when those Betty bombers come in, they touched down, you could hear that just the roar shook the island, you might say, and then it hushed right up. It was kind of an awe-inspiring experience right there. Because those Japanese were pretty gutty guys, boy. Come in and land in a bunch of men like that.
Well, and here's the implication. This was early August, about August 10th of 1945.
I think so, yeah.
The official surrender was imminent. And this party on the Betty Bombers, these were Japanese dignitaries who were meeting with General MacArthur to complete the terms of surrender, correct?
That's right. And I thought it took a lot of nerve for the four guys to come there and face the whole American Army, boy.
You think they should have been nervous?
I bet they were nervous. Carrying bouquets of flowers.
Did that, when you saw that, did that give you hope that you might be going home to your wife and daughter soon?
We was pretty sure we was. But before that, we was pretty sure we was going into Japan.
Mm-hmm.
When we saw that, we figured it all over. Of course, it wasn't for a day or two, but yeah.
Where were you when you found out that it was all over?
Well, I was in charge of quarters, and a TVX came in, and I went over where there's a poker game going. A gambler that I knew, his name was LeChance, and we'd heard a lot of false rumors, and he was just wanting to go home awful bad, and I just threw that TVX out in the middle of the pot, and I said, LeChance, you can go home now. Get back. The war's over. And he never even looked up. And when I finally said, this is official. Nobody had made much noise. He just couldn't believe it.
Well, I imagine after all
a lot
that
of
time,
times you got the idea the white war was going to go on forever, you know.
Well, and it may have if some of the events of August 1945 had not taken place. If those bombs were dropped, you may have ended up in Japan.
Yeah. Oh, we would have. With my part of my outfit was on the boat ready to go in there.
Wow. Well, we're going to take our final commercial break. But when we come back, Don, I would love to hear from you about what it felt like to get back home, to see your wife again, to see your daughter having grown so much while you were gone. And maybe hear some more poetry from you as well. Don Kitterman of Mount Shasta is our guest today. We'll be right back with the home stretch of Hometown Heroes. It's News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. The time always goes by so quickly, especially when we haven't had a show for a while. Remember, no program next week. We'll be bumped off by the New Mexico Bowl when Fresno State plays Wyoming in Albuquerque. But the following week, that'll be the day after Christmas, we'll return. And I think we'll be on every week for a while. So you can look forward to some more great stories from World War II veterans like the ones we've heard today from 90-year-old Don Kitterman. He lives now in Mount Shasta. After the war, he spent a lot of time in Fresno as a contractor before retiring back to his hometown. And I understand during the war, Don, you spent some time at Hammer Field. I imagine Fresno was a little different back then.
Yeah, it was considerably different. I go to Fresno today and I hardly know where I am. That town has surely grown.
Now, when you were in Fresno, it was just before you shipped off overseas. So you had your wife and your daughter here. Then you go off and you told your wife you'd be back. You were a man of your word. But tell me how that happened. Describe for me your reunion and what it felt like to get back home to see her face. And I imagine your daughter was completely different than when you left, too. She'd probably grown up quite a bit.
That's right. I got in. This wasn't quite as a homecoming I'd like to head it. My father had been killed in the meantime in an accident. But I got a discharge at Fort Lewis, and I got into Klamath Falls where Irma met me at my people's house. My mother was an invalid. And, my little daughter wanted to sleep with her mother off of that. And she was a cute little gal.
Did she know who you were when you showed up?
Oh, yeah, she knew who I was. I think she remembers when I came home.
She'd probably had a picture of you in uniform on the nightstand or something.
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah. But no, that was a rather different homecoming than most soldiers had. It was pretty sad to come home, and neither of my parents was there to greet me. And in August, when I got overseas, my mother had a paralytic stroke and was paralyzed. And my dad later got killed just before Christmas, so it got kind of sticky.
Well, and you know, I think that really puts a face on what people today are dealing with, too. And oftentimes we don't understand what a personal sacrifice and struggle it is for American soldiers to be overseas. Things happen with their family, and they can't necessarily do things about it. They're over there serving a purpose, and so much respect for the men and women serving our country today and our all-volunteer force.
You bet.
And I want to ask you, I'm going to read another one of your poems here, and I know you've got dozens of them. We don't have time to read them all, but I think one that really speaks to what we're talking about will be appropriate to wrap up the show here today. I do want to ask you before I get to that, what, you know, for those people that weren't around during World War II, people my age who maybe haven't learned that much about it in school, don't know what it was all about, can you give us a sense of what you were fighting for, why you did what you did, and what your motivation was?
Well, I was a little older than most kids that fought in that war. I was 21, 22, and I was worried about the nation, and I'm worried about it again today. But that was more of my feeling. Most kids just either wanted to go or didn't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured that I should go.
Well, you clearly...
I don't know. I can't tell you. I can't answer that question very good.
Well, maybe your poem here will shed some light on where you stand on that. Now, this, I understand you wrote just about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
The 4th of July Flag Waver. This is, again, by Don Kitterman, and I'll go ahead and read it for him. I'm tired of hearing our nation spurned, and I'm more than outraged when our flag is burned. Called freedom of expression by lesser men, if they only knew where that flag had been. Just since this century has began, it waved at Bougainville, Hollandia, Bataan, Chateau Thierry, and Belleau Wood, and there where the heroes of Bastogne stood. Over in China, on our ship Panay, Omaha Beach, on a stormy day. Suribachi Top, the summit of hell, a tropical island called Guadalcanal. Tarawa, Palermo, Africa Sand, Vietnam, Korea, Thailand. Pearl Harbor, Okinawa, and plenty more. Kuwait, the moon, Corregidor. And don't let them tell you America's done, for it's still the best land under the sun. So let's be proud of our nation, and if you would, wave our flag. It's still looking good. What inspired you to put those words down on paper there, Don?
I couldn't say. That was about the time when some of the younger people was burning the flag in public, and he heard a lot about it, and I thought I'd write something to contradict it a little bit.
Well, and I think it puts in perspective what that flag represents and the American lives that have paid for the freedom that we have to sit here and talk about your experience from so long ago.
You bet.
Well done, sir. And if it's all right with you, I think I'll post that poem on our website. I think there might be a few people that want to borrow that and spread it around.
If you would, please.
Now, we've just got a couple minutes left here. Anything that we haven't covered, any special memories from World War II that stand out in your mind about what life was like and what people were like back then?
Well, it's a poor way to end this the conversation, I guess, but I was on a little island called Biak.
Right.
On Christmas Eve, 1944, and our colonel had sent an airplane down to Hollandia and picked up some mail for our Christmas. It hadn't been coming through. And in that was a little V-mail letter from my wife saying they had buried my dad over by his father in Oregon, and I heard nothing more for about 2.5 months.
Mm.
And that kind of put a hiatus on that story.
Well, and that's a slice of what life was like for you, not the Christmas you envisioned.
Yeah, Christmas Eve is not my favorite holiday.
Well, Christmas Eve is coming up. I trust that it's going to be better in 2009 than it was 65 years ago.
Yeah.
Don, thank you so much for serving our country, for being willing to share some of those stories with us today, and thanks for your great poetry, too.
Where will this go? What station will you be on?
This is going to be on KMJ in Fresno.
I see. Mm-hmm. And it's... You don't know what time.
It'll be at 1 o'clock on Saturday, and what I'll do after it airs, I'll get some CDs to your daughter, and as many copies of it as you'd like. I'll make sure
all right.
Get to you.
Thank you.
No problem. Well, thank you,
sir. I'm sorry I missed your call yesterday. I don't usually do that.
No problem. And maybe one of these days I'll get the privilege of shaking your hand.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, Don, thank you so much for serving our country, for being willing to visit and share some of those stories with us today, and for your great poetry. It's outstanding. And again, I will post, I'll post both of those poems on our website at kmjnow.com. Just scroll through the personalities, click on my name, Paul Leffler, and on my Hometown Heroes blog, you will see those poems and some other information about today's guest. Remember to email me about the World War II veteran in your life. That's paul@kmjnow.com. We'll be off next week because of Bulldog football in the New Mexico Bowl against Wyoming. We'll return the day after Christmas with the next installment of Hometown Heroes. Thanks for listening today right here on News Talk 580 KMJ.